Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online, After Midnight.
There are stories we inherit whether we want them or not. Bloodlines that pass down more than just hair color, more than just names or habits. Some families hand down wealth, others trauma, others secrets so sharp they cut every generation that tries to hold them. And sometimes what's inherited isn't something you can see at all. Sometimes it's the shadows. For as long as she can remember, she has felt it. That sensation of being watched. Not in the casual way we all feel when someone stares a little too long. Not in the harmless paranoia of walking alone at night. This was sharper. A pinpoint pressure, like eyes drilling into the back of her skull. She could always tell exactly where it was, like her body had a compass needle trained on whatever hid in the dark. It never felt good, never benign. It scared her. It was a predator's gaze, not a guardian's. Something that liked to play, to tease, to pull at the edges of her sanity, just enough to make her question herself. She would catch movement in her periphery, shadows darting at the edge of sight, slipping out of reach when she turned her head. Little reminders that she wasn't alone and maybe never would be. She tells me, I need to get rid of it. That's what this is all about. But to understand why she says that, you have to go back. Because this isn't just one haunting, one bad house, one brush with the supernatural. This is blood. This is legacy. This is inheritance. She says she's the apprentice of a deceased hunter. That hunter was her father. At the time, she didn't understand what he was doing. To her, it looked like a father taking his daughter out to the woods. He told her they were deer hunting, but later she realized something odd. There were no deer in the places he brought her. The land wasn't even designated for it. He wasn't teaching her to track animals. He was teaching her something else. At 6 years old, she learned how to move silently, how to ghost her way through underbrush without breaking a twig. He taught her the four guns he owned, not just how to fire them, but how to listen, how to read the world around her. The difference between a natural sound in the woods and something unnatural trying to mimic it. He tested her constantly, puzzle after puzzle, riddles meant to train her mind as much as her body. She didn't know then that he was preparing her for something far beyond hunting season. She only knew he pushed her harder than her brother, that he seemed to demand something from her he didn't demand from anyone else. Then came the house in Buffalo. It was supposed to be home. Instead, it was a crucible. She hated that house, still does. She remembers it as haunted, not in the subtle ways most people use that word, but openly, violently. A little girl lingered there named Mary. At least that's the name she gave. And Mary was friendly in her own way. She became her best friend, someone to talk to when she was lonely. But Mary would never leave the house. She was trapped, tied to the walls and the foundation, unable to follow her into the daylight. And Mary wasn't alone. There was something else in that house, something darker. She remembers waking in the middle of the night to find all her toys floating around her. Picture that. Being 8 years old, opening your eyes and seeing dolls and blocks circling your bed like planets around a sun. It sounds like the kind of story you'd make up, a child's dream warped into memory. But she swears it happened, and it got worse. One day in the basement with her stepbrother, a brick launched itself across the room, nearly striking him in the head. That was the day she ran screaming upstairs, lungs burning, throat raw with terror. The nightmares came next, grotesque dreams no child should have to see. She'd wake tangled in her sheets, heart hammering, drenched in fear. And yet, she says she wasn't afraid of the dreams themselves. Not really. It was only when she felt the other presence, the one that wasn't Mary, that true fear set in. Her father noticed. He gave her a small black Bible, a talisman to hold in the night. It soothed her in ways nothing else could. But the question remained, why had he brought them there? Why had he made his family live in a house so clearly wrong? She'll never know. Because the house is gone. Condemned after they left, wiped from maps as if it had been erased. Try to find it now and you'll come up empty. As if the earth itself swallowed it whole. But the scars it left didn't disappear. By the time she was 10, her father had grown restless. She remembers him standing at the altar of their church praying. Not in the quiet, dutiful way most parishioners do, but in a way that seemed urgent. Desperate. Like he was asking for something big, something final. And then, in May of 2003, everything collapsed. It was the Monday after Mother's Day when he died. They called it suicide. That's what the records say. What the whispers carried, but she never believed it. She still doesn't. That morning, she left her school books by the door. She planned to call him, ask him to bring them to her later. She never made that call, and she has lived ever since with the conviction that she should have stayed home that day. The night before, she overheard him speaking to her mother and stepmother, words spiraling in circles, speaking riddles only she could understand. It was, she believes, his last puzzle for her. His last way of saying what he couldn't say outright. It took her 6 years to piece it together, and when she did, the conclusion chilled her to the core. Her father didn't kill himself, something else killed him. Something he had spent his life preparing her to face. After her father's death, the world tilted. On paper, it was suicide. That's what the official records said, what neighbors whispered, what even some family members accepted. But deep in her bones, she rejected it. She knew her father. She knew the way he thought, the way he tested her, the way he layered riddles inside everyday life. His death wasn't a surrender. It was a message, a final desperate move in a game she hadn't been ready to play. She remembers the guilt most of all. Leaving her books by the door that morning, planning to call him later, she never did. She tells me, I knew it was too late. For years, that regret gnawed at her. If she had called, maybe things would have been different. Maybe she could have stopped it. The night before, he'd been speaking in circles, code only she could decipher. It was the last puzzle, one she carried unsolved for 6 long years. And when she finally cracked it, she understood. Her father hadn't taken his own life. Something had taken him. Something he'd been fighting. And if that was true, then his training hadn't been about games or puzzles or even survival skills. He had been forging her into a weapon. The daughter of a hunter. She believes that one day she'll pick up where he left off, that when the time is right, she'll hunt. She doesn't claim to fully understand yet, doesn't pretend to know every piece of what he fought. But she feels the calling every day. The weight of it, the unfinished work of her bloodline, and with that weight comes fear. Because no matter where she goes, no matter where she lays her head at night, the feeling is there, the eyes, the watching. Even in her own home, especially in her own home, she feels the gaze. She's never rid of it. She keeps weapons by her bed. 3 knives, a katana, always within arm's reach. Their comfort, if not protection. Because how do you stab what you can't see? How do you fight what lives in shadows? Still, having steel close by steadies her hand when the air grows heavy. The only problem, she admits, is she can't take them outside. She walks in daylight, barehanded, knowing she's exposed. And the dreams haven't stopped. She doesn't call them nightmares. To her, they're too vivid, too layered to be dismissed as just bad dreams. They come like visions, scenes that leave her shaken but also sharpened. Most people would label them night terrors. She calls them reminders. Her therapist calls her normal, not depressed, not delusional, just stressed with a touch of insomnia. But normal doesn't feel like the right word. Normal doesn't cover the moments when the veil between worlds feels paper thin. She knows people think she's insane. She's heard it, felt it in their tones, but she doesn't care. She has her beliefs, and she has her purpose. One day, she says, when the time comes, she'll be gone, off to fight the thing that stole her father, off to finish what he started. She points out the hypocrisy of belief, how so many will swear by angels, speak of them with reverence, but scoff at demons. You can't have one extreme without the other, she says. And she's right. For every light, there's a shadow. For every guardian, a predator. And if you trace her family tree, you see those shadows branching through generations. On her mother's side, spiritual gifts are as common as hair color. Her great-grandmother knew everything. Not in the vague way fortune tellers throw predictions, with precision, exact dates. She knew the day her daughter would give birth to a son, and the day that son would die. She foresaw her daughter's marriage to a man who would later train their child to hunt. She even knew the exact time and day of her own death. The gift, if you can call it that, ran deep. Sometimes it came as visions, sometimes as dreams, sometimes as uncanny knowing, an intuition that bent reality. Her mother inherited it in small doses, not constant, but flashes, moments where the world peeled back and she saw what others couldn't. Her cousin carried it too, though hers was tied to dreams, dark dreams, prophecies that never ended well. The first time they met, her cousin looked her straight in the eye and said, "You're the one I've been dreaming about." Before she could ask what that meant, her grandmother rushed in, stopped the conversation cold, wouldn't let her cousin explain. That silence, what was hidden in those dreams, still haunts her more than anything. What was so terrible that they wouldn't even tell her? Every family has its secrets, but in hers, the secrets walk. They breathe. They linger in the smell of roses and cigars, the scents that announce her great-grandmother and her lover are nearby, visiting from the other side. She smelled it with her mother, the presence undeniable, though unseen. What she herself has, she isn't sure. No visions, no prophetic dreams. The closest thing is the eyes. Whenever she closes her own, she sees them, multiplying, shifting, watching her from every angle. Eyes upon eyes, moving and changing until they fill her inner world. She can't count them, can't make sense of them. They overwhelm her. Sometimes the visions leave her dizzy, collapsed by migraines that come too strong, too early for her age. It feels like inheritance, twisted together. Spiritualists on her mother's side, soldiers and hunters on her father's. One rooted in the unseen, one trained in combat. And here she is, caught between the two. Which path is hers? She doesn't know yet, but maybe she thinks she'll be both. She lives now in a kind of half-life, torn between the ordinary demands of her 20s and the extraordinary legacy she never asked for. To outsiders, she's just another young woman navigating work, sleep, rent, the grind of everyday survival. But inside, the tension coils. Every hallway feels watched. Every darkened room carries weight. Every dream feels like rehearsal for something that hasn't yet arrived. And maybe that's what unsettles her the most, the sense of waiting. She has knives by her bed, a katana she polishes even though she's never had reason to use it. She sharpens them, not just for protection, but for ritual. Steel, cold, and tangible is an anchor in a world where nothing else feels solid. She can't take them out of the house, laws, social norms, common sense, but inside they're talismans. She knows it's absurd, knows you can't cut a shadow, but she also knows her father never carried a weapon for nothing. Because she isn't just anyone. She is the daughter of a hunter, and hunters don't stop. It's a dangerous inheritance. The child of a preacher feels compelled to pray. The child of a soldier feels compelled to serve. The child of a hunter feels compelled to hunt. It isn't duty in the conventional sense. It's bone deep, hardwired. A rhythm passed down like heartbeat, and the moment she admitted to herself that her father hadn't died by his own hand, that something else had claimed him, that rhythm became a vow. One day, she will hunt. One day, she will find what took him. One day, she will end it. But how do you hunt what stalks you in silence? How do you fight what only reveals itself in bruises and migraines and the smell of roses and cigars lingering in a room you thought was empty? That's the paradox she lives inside. She's armed but powerless, a warrior in waiting, bristling with blades, but never certain what to strike. Her family history gnaws at her. Generations of spiritualists, prophets, dreamers, people who saw death before it came. Her great-grandmother, so exact she predicted the day and hour of her own passing. Her cousin, tormented by dreams of her, cut off before she could explain. Her mother, visited by visions that fall like lightning, unexpected and unbidden. And then there's her. She doesn't see the future. She doesn't speak to the dead. What she has is stranger, less defined. The eyes, the visions that come every time she closes her own. Hundreds, thousands of eyes, multiplying and shifting until she can't tell where one ends and another begins. Always watching. Always moving. It's not just unsettling. It's intimate. Because the eyes aren't distant, like something spied from across a field. They're close, too close, filling the space behind her lids, pressing against her skull, searing into her brain, watching not just her body, but her thoughts, her very sense of self. She wonders sometimes if those eyes are hers, if she's looking at herself multiplied into something alien, or if she's the prey in some larger hunt, pinned under the gaze of something that has been following her since childhood. That's the question that keeps her awake most nights. Not whether she'll hunt, but whether she's already being hunted. And the body keeps score. Migraines that drop her to the ground, spinning the room until she can't tell which way is up. Pain that shouldn't come at her age. Agony that feels older than her bones. Doctors call them stress, genetics, flukes. She calls them messages. Because the timing is always precise. A migraine after a dream. A migraine after a night of heavy eyes behind her lids. A migraine after waking with the sense that something was standing in the corner of her room. It feels less like biology and more like invasion. And yet, she refuses to fold. She tells me, once I can go, I'm gone. Off to fight for what they took. That's not the bravado of youth. That's the resolve of someone who has carried a puzzle since childhood and finally knows the shape of its answer. She doesn't claim to have all the tools yet. She doesn't pretend she's ready today. But readiness, for her, isn't optional. It's inevitable. She doesn't doubt the existence of demons, of spirits. She doesn't debate their reality the way skeptics do. For her, the question was never if. It was always when. And the when is coming, and she's not blind to how people see her. She knows some roll their eyes, call her insane, dismiss her as another young woman weaving her trauma into fantasy. She doesn't care. She has her beliefs, and she has her proof. Proof in the puzzles her father left behind. Proof in the house erased from Buffalo's maps. Proof in the cousin's warning cut off before it could be spoken. Proof in the bruises, the migraines, the screams in the dark. And so she sharpens her knives, polishes her katana, practices patience in a world that doesn't even believe the battle she's preparing for exists. Because when the time comes, she'll be ready. The story could end there with the image of a young woman waiting in the dark, steel at her bedside. But it doesn't. Because her life isn't static, it keeps unfolding. Each new day, another reminder that the shadows haven't given up. She still feels it. The watching, the presence, the thing that's been there since she was a child, giggling at something unseen in her room, the thing that hovered in Buffalo, the thing that claimed her father. It hasn't stopped. And so the haunting continues, not as a single event, but as a life, a rhythm, a legacy. The daughter of a hunter born into a bloodline of soldiers and seers, waiting, preparing, haunted not just by shadows in the night, but by the knowledge that one day soon she'll stop waiting. One day she'll stop being prey. One day she'll hunt. And when she does, God help whatever she finds in the dark.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to...
get your bag!
Two ways to peel for a chance to...
get your bag!
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to...
get your bag!
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.